It's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campo-Minosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College, paid for by Kevin Spriggs Enterprises. And good morning, Dr. Lou.
Well, good morning to you, Mark. Certainly, one of these days where, you know, it's just the Easter season, and yet we're having to work, okay? And I think that it's important that we take advantage of the time that we have. And although it is over the Easter season, I felt like, you know, it's best to go ahead and pre-record this so that we'll have our show for Monday. I wouldn't have to, you know, pull something out of the hat from way back when and say, well, here, let's just run that. So I really appreciate the fact that you're here. And I know that Lori was looking forward to having her time off with her grandchildren in North Carolina. So this is going to work out fine for us, and I really appreciate your being here for us today.
Our pleasure.
What do we want to do today? So, you know, Lori really gave me all sorts of grief last Monday because I didn't really get into Trump's indictment. And I said, well, listen, you know, this is Monday. The indictment's coming out Tuesday. I'll talk about it the next time we have a show. So that's one of the things that I do want to do today is take a look at the indictment and go through that. Okay. I also want to kind of roll into, you know, that whole issue of what this indictment really means in terms of the legal system and where we are with some sort of a dual system of justice. And I don't think that we can close our eyes to that. And so I want to just talk about that as when it's appropriate after I talk about the indictment. I also want to try to hit what's going on with Taiwan. You know, Taiwan's President Xi has been over here meeting with our congressmen and others. She's also conducting a tour into Central America to try to repair some of their relations with Central Americans. And, of course, she met with Kevin McCarthy, and, of course, the Chinese government, the Communist Party, went crazy. So we want to talk about that and kind of set the stage for yet another discussion about what is really going on with Taiwan and how it impacts on what we're doing. And, of course, the context of this really is Joe Biden's foreign policy and the failures therein that may very well lead to something along the lines of a, you know, Ukrainian situation in the Taiwan Straits. I want to talk a little bit about that. Then I want to try to close with talking about the things that Stephanie Dernan from Health Freedom spoke with us about last Monday, a couple of bills that they had, and want to just give you an update on where we are with that. And that should take care of the day. So Mark, without any further ado, I'm hoping that Lori will be able to listen to this because she was so interested in the indictment. So here's the discussion about the indictment, okay? I think it's clear that even critics of Trump on the left and some of the never-Trumpers like Mitt Romney have pretty much called this a very weak case, okay? So if it's a weak case, why is that? Well, in the first instance, critics are saying D.A. Bragg did not spell out what the crime was, okay? He just went through 34 indictments of this, that, and the other, and they all kind of relate to the same thing. The argument here is basically that this case was poor to begin with. Cyrus Vance, who had been the Manhattan DA, had an opportunity to pursue it, and he did not pursue it. Bragg, when he first came into office, did not pursue it. Then suddenly he changed his mind and decided to pursue it. Okay? The FEC, the Federal Election Commission, who really has final say about this, did not prosecute Trump over any kind of an FEC violation. So the question has to be raised, you know, people are saying it's a weak case. It seems to have been a weak case for both Bragg and his predecessor and for the FEC. So what's going on? And as many people have suggested, is Trump just going to have this thrown out because of the nature of the case being so weak? Well, we'll see how that goes. And, of course, that's a sidebar on this whole question. The judge who is handling it is one of these, you know, Biden supporters, been heavily involved in Democratic politics. His family's involved with it. So when you take that into account and the nature of the Manhattan jury pool, who are going to be very much anti-Trump, the real question is, if the judge does not throw this out, is Trump going to get a fair trial? So would they be, would this judge be willing to move the trial to a different location? Well, you can bet your boompy that he is not going to move it out of Manhattan. Although, as, you know, Rudy Giuliani pointed out, he did move a case out of Manhattan despite the fact that, you know, he didn't want to do it, but for justice's sake, he did. Well, you can keep your eye on that and see what happens with it. So the point here being, though, the case is weak. Will the judge throw it out on the merits? We'll have to see about that, okay? But I do think, you know, this whole question about what's really going on with this takes us into the broader discussion of the nature of what seems to be coming about is a dual system of justice. One for thee and one for me. And in this case, when it comes to Trump, it's quite clear that, well, let's put it this way. If you think that how Trump has been treated over the years since he walked down that escalator, if you think that what took place in terms of how not only the Democratic Party, which is natural, they're going to go against him, I get that, but look at what happened with the FBI. Look what happened in terms of how they intervened. And again, you don't have to take my word for it, but look at the record that Elon Musk showed what had taken place with the FBI moving to try to stop any kind of discussion about Hunter Biden's laptop before the 2020 election. I mean, Elon Musk did us a great favor by showing what happened there, okay? So, okay, yeah, I'm the crazy right-wing Dr. Lunatic. I get that. But guess what? I'm not the one that's laying out the evidence there. The evidence is pretty clear, Mark.
Well, they say it's not, what is it, you're not paranoid if they really are out to get you?
Oh, yeah, right. Well, that's Kissinger's old argument was that, you know, even paranoids have real enemies. Okay, so, but here again, I mean, the Musk, you know, laying out the case here certainly suggests, it tells you what they did. So the FBI, the premier law enforcement agency in the country and one of the best in the world, they're crackerjack at what they're doing, what they do. I get that. So how does one explain their actions against Trump? Okay? So you have the Twitter files, the intervention. Even worse, though, is that the FBI knew the dossier that Hillary Clinton had paid for by a foreign agent was false. Okay? The FBI knew that, and yet they manipulated the Pfizer system to get a warrant to spy on Trump's campaign. Now, if the predicate for the Pfizer warrant was the dossier, and the dossier was known to be false, what does that tell you Okay? Again, it's not Dr. Lunatic going crazy. It's facts on the ground that are determining where we should look for, you know, our interpretation of how all of this fits into this dual system of justice theory. So, in fact, I don't think it's a theory anymore. You've got facts on the ground that contradict any idea that this was not a setup, that this was not a deliberate attempt to get a candidate before he became the president, and that they continued their attempts to derail Trump at any cost. Thus, this whole business with the Mueller, you know, investigation. This whole business with two attempts at impeachment, both of which failed. The huge attempt to use the January 6th protests as an insurrection pinned on Trump. And of course, that's still an ongoing investigation. So frame this along the lines of Bragg's indictment, the continuing investigation about classified information, which has spilled over into yet another part of the January 6th commission, as well as what's going down in Fulton County, Georgia, where the DA there is trying to hang Trump for interfering with Georgia's election by asking that incredibly idiotic Raffensperger, who was the Secretary of State, to try to find 11,000 votes, which was the difference in the Georgia election. Now, that must have been a real outrageous thing for Raffensperger to have to deal with, because he knew that Stacey Abrams had contributed to taking away the constitutional approach to the 2020 elections with her consent decree that basically forced the Secretary of State of Georgia not to conform with the state's legal responsibilities when it came to marrying up names on their mailed-in ballots with people who were registered. Now, here again, that's not old Dr. Lunatic talking about this. Those are facts on the ground. Facts on the ground proved, once again, by the fact that Raffensperger and even Governor Kemp did not challenge Stacey Abrams' consent decree in court. Whereas, if you look carefully, Secretary of State Merrill, at the same time, back in 2020, was sued by the Southern Poverty Law Center over the Alabama ID requirement as being discriminatory for elections. Merrill went to the Supreme Court of the United States and won. No discrimination about ID requirements. Why didn't Kemp and Raffensperger do the same thing on the consent decree, which had completely unraveled the Georgia constitutional electoral system? They didn't, because they didn't like, and they still don't like Trump. Be that as it may, my point here is that, just given the litany of things I've already talked about, it's impossible at this juncture to come to any other conclusion than the state, the establishment of both parties, both Republican and Democrats, did not want Trump. And they were willing to do anything extra legal to stop him. They couldn't stop him. So once he became president, they just continued moving along a different path. So again, I raise the question, have we now gotten to the point where we have this dual justice system? Well, let's kind of look at some other examples. Does the weaponization of the FBI by the teachers' unions and others, to where parents who are speaking out against what's going on in schools they pay for, they have been labeled as terrorists? And here again, the Department of Justice gets a memo, and the next thing you know, you've got these kinds of issues bubbling up to suppress parents from talking about issues pertaining to the education of their children. Okay? I mean, how do you interpret that? So, again, the weaponization of the political system by the DOJ, and the examples are out there, okay? So, just giving you one there. But the fact of the matter is, if we're going down this road, which I think we're there, how do we stop it? And once again, we get back into a fundamental question. And it's been mentioned on some of the TV pundits that George Washington made this point about factions, that if you have factions in our new country at the time, then you are not going to be able to have a country for very long. Madison had a different view about that, okay? Now, let me just as a side note say that Madison's view, and you certainly saw this in the Federalist Papers, basically argued that factions can be seen as something else. They can be seen as people who have different views, okay? But in Washington's view, factions were extremely detrimental to the good functioning of the country. Now, the interpretation, the current interpretation that you can make about factions is closely related to the fact that the Marxists who are attempting to take over this country, and you, oh God, Dr. Liu, you're crossing into McCarthyite stuff here. Yeah, and guess what? McCarthy was right. There were communists in the government that even Truman had to get rid of some people in the State Department for communist affiliation. So I don't want to hear about McCarthyism, okay? But I will say this. Is it McCarthyism to talk about what BLM and Antifa are doing? How is it that neither one of those have had people, you know, caught and put in jail for what they've done? Okay? And you don't have to go back too far. Just look at the 2020 riots. That's BLM and Antifa. I mean, BLM's whole argument is that the oppressors are not going to get away with oppressing people of color anymore. And so that's their main goal, to overturn this system. And along with them, they use Antifa as the militant military wing of this Marxist movement. So here you have a system of justice that gives a pass to Antifa and BLM violence. You have DAs sponsored by our friend George Soros, and Bragg in New York is a classic example of this. He has decriminalized, will not prosecute all sorts of felonies. Thus you have murder rates going sky high. You have carjackings going sky high. You've had robberies going sky high. All of the criminal indices are off the page. But it's not just New York. It's Chicago. It's San Francisco. It's Los Angeles. It's anywhere the Democrats are in charge where Soros has been able to manipulate the the prosecutorial system by putting in, with his money, these district attorneys who are essentially making it impossible for the citizens in those cities to live the way Americans should live, with a sense of safety and well-being when they go out to do their normal business. I mean, how many examples of this do you have to see on TV with random violence in the streets of New York? One guy comes up behind somebody, shoots him in the back. You know, one guy tries to take a bodega, store and rob it. The poor guy who's defending himself is charged by Bragg with killing the attacker. And I mean, this just goes on and on and on. So let's not kid ourselves that somewhere along the line we have crossed over from a theoretical discussion about the possibilities of what could happen, because it's happening. And so what are we going to do about this? And at this juncture, and here again, this, I've said all this before, because we live in Alabama, we are insulated from having to deal with the worst aspects of all this. Thank God that's the case. But the reality is that because we don't have to live through it, then do our elected officials understand the danger? Can we convey to them our feelings in such a way that they grasp that this is their time to stand up and say absolutely no to what's going on? So where's the sense of urgency about it? Do we hear a sense of urgency from any of our elected officials, from the congressional districts, from Tuberville, from Britt? I mean, Tuberville's done some decent things here lately. But here again, as a totality, our congressional folks are just kind of whistling in the dark. They are not coming out and saying, this is a crisis, we are going to stop what's going on. Yes, there have been some attempts by Kevin McCarthy in the House to do some of these things. And thank goodness they're trying to do that. But the reality is, we're so far removed from being able to influence what's going on in D.C. that the only thing we can do, and I say this in terms of our listening area here, is to get in touch with Jerry Carl and make the point to Jerry Carl, our congressman, that we demand that he stands up in Congress and says what needs to be said about pointing out that we are not going to go down the slippery slope of a dual justice system simply because the establishment Republicans and the establishment Democrats and the far left Democrats want this Marxist approach to be instituted. That's where we are with this. So my point here is, and I will do this within the Common Sense campaign framework and the Alabama State Coalition, Conservative Coalition framework, that we will start pressing our representatives and our two state senators, Tuberville and Britt, to start being outspoken critics of what the hell is going on. We need to do it before it's too late. Although there are people that are going to say it is too late. So back to Washington and the factions. How do you reasonably discuss issues with people like Antifa and BLM? I mean, just look at the history of communist control of various countries. Think about it. In order to control, you have to kill to keep power. Mao did it. Stalin did it. The Gulag was real. Putin is still doing it. Xi in China is doing it. And yet, we think that we're protected by First Amendment rights and things like that. They're words. They're words on paper. And guess what? When the people who have the power don't believe in those words, and our enemies don't believe in it, I mean domestic and foreign, they don't believe in that. We are in the way of their power. We are in the way of letting them do what they want. And as such, they will do everything they can to make sure we are sidelined, ineffective, and eventually just part of the anthill. That's what they want. So, there was an old phrase from Germany during the Weimar Republic. Deutschland erwachen. Germany awake. Well, we're here with that. Are we going to awaken in time? Some are saying that it's too late. I don't agree with that. I think that we can awaken in time. But if we can't deal with what's happening through the process we have right now, where we find people who are going to prosecute BLM and Antifa and shut them down. Antifa is a terrorist organization. It's that simple. Biden and them are not going to call them out. I get that. But we have district attorneys throughout the states that can start pressing them. So that's the challenge we face right now. This country is on the cusp of going over the edge. And if it goes over the edge, we're all going to pay the price. Right now, Trump is the only person really paying the price. So we better hope that Trump prevails. And once again, we get back to this whole question about, you know, the forthcoming primary, you know, and whether or not Trump will be able to prevail in the Republican primary. According to the polls and the money he's raised, he probably will. But at the same time, we have to understand that the electoral system itself is part of the problem. And yes, some of these states have taken steps to eliminate what happened in 2020. But the big question mark is, how effective are those reforms going to be? As we talked about last week, election integrity is one of the issues that the Alabama Conservative Coalition is most concerned about here in Alabama. And there is a bill now that is being, it was passed out of committee in the Senate. It's going, and then passed throughout the Senate. It'll go to the House. And it provides for paper ballots being part of the process and a complete elimination of any kind of connection to the internet So we'll see how this works itself out. But that's Alabama doing its job to try to improve the integrity of its system. And what I can try to do is give us a discussion about where the battleground states are in terms of dealing with their own electoral questions. Well, we'll do that over the course of the next few weeks. At this particular point, I want to kind of transition to this issue of Taiwan once again. Okay? I've mentioned before that, particularly with Lieutenant Commander Cox on with us, that the real question about Taiwan turns on a couple of issues, okay? Issue number one is the degree to which Joe Biden, who has been wrong on so many foreign policy issues throughout his career, is the right person to be in charge in terms of trying to deal with a China that has a plan to supplant the United States as the world superpower. That's what they want to do. Okay? So that's one issue. The question of leadership here at home. The second issue is, how does Taiwan deter the Chinese Communist Party from moving against Taiwan? Those two issues are intertwined, okay? And it seems to me self-evident that even when you look at Biden's past performance being wrong on so many issues, foreign policy issues, as Gates pointed out in his book, okay? You don't have to dig deep to find out just how screwed up Biden is in his foreign policy approaches. And of course, case number one is Afghanistan, the debacle there. And of naturally, just yesterday, John Kirby, from the spokesman for the National Security Council, is now coming out with the new version of why everything was so chaotic as Biden withdrew from Afghanistan. They blamed it on Trump. Okay? They said the Trump and his team didn't help us in the transition. They didn't have a plan for withdrawal. Well, all I can say is this. Let's just assume for a second that Trump was actually going to move out of Afghanistan as they had talked about doing. I've mentioned this to you before, that everything Trump was doing was based on facts on the ground. Those facts on the ground had already gone south before he left. Okay? So Trump was going to, had he been reelected, Trump would have been faced with having to deal with a resurgent Taliban, with issues pertaining to the Taliban not agreeing to what they had said that they would agree with in the initial discussions they had with Trump's team. Okay? So just think about this. Trump never would have followed what Biden did in terms of how he withdrew. So let's just run the reel back to January 20, 2021, and Trump is the president. He's meeting with his national security team, he's meeting with his Defense Department people, he's meeting with Pompeo, And they suddenly realize that their hopes for moving forward with a withdrawal are not going to be possible because of facts on the ground. What do you think Trump would have done? Do you think he would have just done what Biden did and came up with an arbitrary time deadline to get out? This is what Biden did. Facts on the ground did not indicate that it was possible to just willy-nilly pull out. And yet that's what Biden did. And he's blaming Trump for that? I mean, it's nuts. But then, hey, nutso is what you get with Biden. It's nuts not to, I've mentioned this to you before, it's nuts not to making sure that Russia doesn't have the money through its oil, selling of oil, to fight in Ukraine. Well, what was the solution to that? Well, American energy, we were number one. We were able to lower the cost of energy through oil and gas because we were producing more of it. It was hurting the Ruskies. I mean, I've mentioned to you, even Tom Friedman and Fareed Zakaria, no friends of the conservative movement, talked about how inadequate Biden's approach to the Ukraine war was on the financial front because he would not unleash American energy to make Russia pay a heavy price. The sanctions aren't working. Okay? And we can talk about that another time. My point here is that Biden's approach in Afghanistan was the problem. Not the fact that he wasn't left with an op plan that said, okay, there's eight, you know, all these thousands of Americans, how are we going to get them out? Trump and them never got to that point, as far as we know. But then, to tell you the truth, I cannot conceive that Pompeo and the Defense Department did not have initial plans that started to talk about evacuation. We haven't seen it yet, but it'll come out. But regardless of whether they had a plan or not, it all turns on facts on the ground. So from the perspective of the Taiwan issue, why would China not think that Biden will cave? Just look at what he's done with Afghanistan. Look at how he's halfway supporting the Ukrainians. And yes, I know he's got a lot of money out there. I get that. But money isn't the only thing that counts. So here you are with, you know, this whole question about where we're going and the degree to which China has to calculate whether or not Biden is a serious opponent when it comes to their desire to reunite. And actually, reunite is not really what this is. China has never really controlled Taiwan, okay? It's been back and forth. When it was called Formosa, hell, they had the Dutch and other European people colonizing it, and then the Chinese tried to take it for a while, and then the Japanese took it in 1885, I think. So Taiwan has never really been under the so-called control of China until Chiang Kai-shek was forced to go to Taiwan because they lost the war against the Chinese communists in 1949. So, but my point here is the Chinese Communist Party thinks Taiwan is theirs. Nixon and Kissinger pretty much gave them a blanket of approval under so-called One China policy. But even there, the One China policy did not, you know, come close to just turning over Taiwan to China. Okay? My point here, again, is what will the Communist Party in China think is going to happen if they decided to cross the straits and try to take Taiwan? Obviously, the Taiwanese are going to fight. But my point to you all before was, this is a time for deterrence to be strong. And what better way to make it stronger than to go ahead and put a Marine regiment there? Okay? Here's another thing that could help raise the deterrence level. According to reports now, the Taiwanese have paid for $19 billion worth of U.S. military equipment to defend themselves. It hasn't been sent. Now, we can argue that Biden is so heavy into sending equipment and all the rest of it to Ukraine that there's nothing left. That may very well be true. But guess what? There has to be a physical sense that Taiwan is a porcupine that cannot be attacked. And if that doesn't happen, if there's no sense on the part of the Chinese on the mainland that this porcupine is just going to be too tough to deal with, and their American Marines who were there too, if they don't get a sense like that, why shouldn't they go ahead and push Biden? And of course, overarching all of this in terms of decision making on Biden's part is how compromised he is with the Chinese government. Oh yes, okay? You can't get away from this. And it's not just Hunter Biden and all the rest of the Biden family. It's the big guy. It's the big guy. So, I mean, Taiwan is playing cards with the DAC stack against them. It's stacked against them because Biden may very well be compromised. Indications of that? Why doesn't he ever talk about the human rights violations that are going on in China? Why doesn't he talk about the unfair trade practices the Chinese inflict? Why doesn't he talk about the damn fentanyl that they're sending into the United States through the open border that he allows? Okay, here's Dr. Lunatic at work here. So am I the lunatic because he's doing all those things, not saying a word about any of it? And yet we're supposed to believe that he's fully capable of resisting the Chinese when he's compromised by those people. Aside from all of the problems he's had with foreign policy through the years, just work through that, that somehow he'll be there and make the right decisions. Maybe. You still have to contend with where we are on the soft approach he takes with China, as compared with Trump. You know, Trump putting major tariffs on them. Trump going after all of these Confucius Institutes. Trump going after TikTok. Trump, excuse me, making sure that the FBI is investigating all of these Chinese who are involved in American education, American business, external people coming in. Biden shut all of that down. Shut it down. So you have to ask yourself the question, pourquoi? Why? Is it because he's got such a great relationship with Xi that he believes that he can work with him? Just like Franklin Roosevelt thought that he could work with Stalin. You see how that worked out. So at this particular point, I would argue that, you know, dealing with Biden and how he's going to approach the possibilities of a China attack on Taiwan, that's one of the key ingredients to figuring out whether or not deterrence is even going to work there. I mean, if he's not willing to send American troops, okay, I got that. That's a heavy load. All right, fine. I'm Dr. Lunatic. Don't want to do that. Okay, fine. But what about getting Taiwan to be that porcupine with its own self-defense? I mean, we could have sent Patriot missiles to Ukraine long before the war started, so that when Russia started sending, you know, planes over to bomb cities, they might have gotten shot out of the sky. But oh no. That's too aggressive. Too much of a problem. So all I'm suggesting to you here is that if Biden is not going to be serious about truly deterring Xi from the temptation of going after Taiwan, because after all, the American presence is not really there. There's no real surety that Biden won't, you know, stand up, then what do you expect is going to happen? I mean, I've read various articles that talk about, you know, the Pacific Fleet Admiral talking about why by 2027, China might be ready. Well, what the hell happens if they're ready next month? Because they assess what's happening, and they believe that Biden is a weak sister. And he will do nothing if they kind of replicate what they did last August when Pelosi visited Taiwan. I mean, that was a pretty serious attempt to demonstrate what China is capable of doing. Naval exercises, air power all over the place, violations of the Taiwanese airspace, Testing, nibbling here, nibbling there, seeing what the weaknesses are, sending balloons over American airspace. I mean, I should have said that when I was giving you my interpretation of the calculus that's going on in Z's mind. I mean, the balloon episode clearly shows how inept or compromised Biden is. So let's just think about that as we deal with, you know, the future and what happens with Taiwan. I'm definitely going to have Commander Cox come back on, and we'll talk more about this, because this isn't going away. But I do think that, you know, as I wrap this show up today, I do want to try to take us back to where we were last week and give us a good update on a couple of the bills that Stephanie Dernan had talked to us about last week. One was the Health Freedom Act, which House Member Ernie Yarborough we're still waiting on that to be filed, okay? So that's an issue where we're getting close to having that done. And once we get that done, we'll certainly get that word out to you. Now, I know that another bill that was important to us that we talked about last week was HB 187, which was a bill that Representative Chip Brown from Mobile actually has filed, okay? This bill is basically going to give parents the right to be notified and to stop any kind of medical procedures with their children, okay? Now, what Stephanie and Health Freedom are trying to do is perhaps put an amendment on that to strengthen it to where, as we talked about last week, giving a new age for medical decision making, rather than being at 14 as it is, moving it up to 18. So we'll see how that goes. That does complicate Chip Brown's bill a bit, but if they're willing to give parents final say-so over what's going on with their children's health, and it kind of ties into what happened last year with the VCAP bill. No one wants to see children being mutilated and given all of these hormones and changes for sex and all the rest of this business. All of that is unnatural, number one, and the parents have a right to intervene on this. Of course, the transgender movement doesn't want to agree to that. I get that. But our point here is that the predicate has been laid to a very large degree to make sure that the parents have a bigger role. It's an indirect role with VCAP because the doctors are not allowed to do the kinds of things the transgenders want, okay? But on the other hand, Chip Brown's bill, HB 187, does specifically give those parents the rights to intervene and say no. And so it's kind of natural, in my view, to add that amendment on there, which would then provide, you know, that medical agency moving from 14 to 18. That makes sense. So, Mark, how much time do I have left? I'm over time already.
Yeah, you got about 60 seconds, Doc.
50 seconds, all right. All right, folks, so this is Good Friday. I hope that you all will have an Easter that is blessed for you, and that you know you will remain in good health. And I will talk to you, I think, on, let's see, Monday the 17th, since we're taping this on Friday the 7th. Have a wonderful Easter. God bless. Take care.
You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campo Minosi with the Common Sense Campaign, an adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College. If you missed part of the show or want to tell a friend, you can listen later at WABF1480.com.